Well, this week, Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk announced that the state is reaffirming its bid to hold the 2032 Olympics in Brisbane. According to the government's VPA, the Value Proposition Assessment, the Southeast Queensland 2032 Olympic and Paralympic Games would deliver billions of dollars in the Queensland economy and over 100,000 jobs for local workers. But is the job of an Olympic host city really as good as it can look on papers like the feasibility assessment that Brisbane's just done? Apparently, on average, Olympic Games budgets exceed their initial budgets by a mere 172%. And the infrastructure for a mega event isn't necessarily the infrastructure that a city needs years or decades down the track. So the Olympic rings are on the roundtable today, and our Olympic ring-ins are from the ABC podcast, The Ticket, Tracy Holmes. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Associate Professor Leonie Loxton-Binney from Griffith University's Business School joins us. Welcome, Leonie.
Thank you.
Leonie has been combing the 2032 Olympic feasibility study. And we're also joined by David Rowe, Emeritus Professor of Cultural Research at Western Sydney University. Welcome, David.
Morning, Gideon.
Now, David, let's start with the basic. It seems like Olympics do have a habit of running over budget. How much does it actually cost to host an Olympic Games?
Well, a lot of money. I was just looking, for example, at London 2012, and the cost, the public cost of the Games was somewhere between 12 and 13 billion pounds, which was well above what the estimate of the cost of the Games. Which is typical, as you pointed out.
It does seem that no matter what the number is, it's always going to be higher. Leonie, you've been looking at the feasibility study. I must say, I did wonder whether there's been many feasibility studies which have come back to a government and just said, absolutely no, do not do this. But the Queensland study apparently gave a tick to feasibility and said at the most fundamental level, the Games should be legacy-led. What on earth does that mean, Leonie? And what did you draw from the feasibility study?
Certainly. So legacy-led is very much about ensuring that what is left behind after the Games is hosted aligns very much to the long-term development plans of Southeast Queensland and also accounts for community perspectives about those planning agendas. So ensuring that there is grassroots input into those long-term development plans. Of course, trying to avoid a more top-down approach where these things are imposed onto local communities. So there are a number of legacies identified within the feasibility study.
Because you've looked into the sort of you've looked into the sort of engagement of stakeholders in that sort of legacy planning, haven't you?
Yes.
and what's the track record there so far?
So certainly we did some work for Sydney and for London, 2012, and they're very interesting games, one of which Sydney was prior to the legacy era, whereas London was very much the first Olympic Games that really had to deliver a legacy. After the Games was hosted, our research at the time indicated that there was very limited stakeholder engagement between the organising committee and the wider stakeholders within the destination. To a degree, that is understandable because the organising committee is, of course, focused on delivering the Games, planning for the Games, whereas legacy is this very much intangible thing that is developing post-Games. And our research indicated that there was, unfortunately, very little resourcing to plan for a legacy. And in the case of London in particular, that legacy planning came quite late in the piece to be effectively developed in terms of a real holistic legacy for London 2012.
Legacy planning that comes late in the piece doesn't sound like a recipe for success, does it? Tracy Holmes, you've looked at some of the research that was done by Oxford University's Said Business School. Now, the report is called regression to the tale, why the Olympics blow up. So that's a bit of a bit of a hint to what they found. What struck you about their research?
What struck me was it was pretty thorough, but also they couldn't find very much detailed and accurate information that really went into how much it cost, how much were the budgets overblown, et cetera, et cetera. And you can understand that because it's in people's interests probably not to be so transparent
in
this regard. But they came up with six steps to better games management. And some of the steps are quite interesting, you know, detailing how you should go about negotiating with the IOC, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get down to the last of their six steps, it says this: finally, and perhaps most effectively, prospective host cities could mitigate their risk by simply walking away from the games. Now, I think they did that as a bit of a, you know, tongue-in-cheek, because when I interviewed one of the authors of the report, he said, you know, obviously, he, like many other people, are fans of the Olympic Games and doesn't believe the world will be a better place without them. However, there are some serious questions as to the organising of them, the cost of them, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely, absolutely. David Rowe, in terms of, I think the term is mega events for something like the Olympics, is it really even possible to map the needs of a mega event with the sort of long-term planning needs of a city when it's not in mega event mode?
Well, the argument generally goes that what the Olympics gives the opportunity to do is to, because it's generally there's about 7 years between the announcement and the actual hosting of the games, is that you could compress a whole lot of development, urban development, which would normally take 15 to 20 years. You can do that in about 7 years and maybe a little bit more beforehand in preparation. So then the question becomes, well, what infrastructure are you going to build, and will it be beneficial to the whole region or the country or the city? So, for example, in the Rio Olympics, the argument was that, you know, for 2016, after that, you would have much better transport to the favelas, which are isolated from the main part of the city, in the beach and so on. So you can, what you then set up is a big battle between different forces over what is the most important form of improving infrastructure.
And I think the Rio Games ran over by 352%. Overall, is there a trend towards doing better in terms of that infrastructure mapping, or is it really, you know, case by case and dependent on the quality of the particular management committee?
Well, there's massive variation across the world. So, I mean, I've been to, you know, various Olympic cities, you know, before and afterwards. I mean, for example, would we hold up Athens 2004 as an example of the excellent use of public funds and the creation of effective infrastructure? Or almost certainly no. In most cases, most of the venues that have been built are now derelict. The famous bird's nest in the 2008 Beijing Olympics was already rusting shortly after the games had finished. But often, as I say, you get improvements in transport, in some public spaces. I would also say something like the Cultural Olympiad is really important. So, I mean, some things that come and go, but it's, you know, nonetheless important. So if you, say, have Sydney 2000, there's a very big Indigenous presence running throughout the games. And I mean, that should also be counted as part of the legacy, I think.
Not just built
things.
Tracy Holmes, what are your thoughts on the infrastructure question?
Look,
in particular?
It's really hard, and I think, you know, people probably don't understand that states, cities, federal governments don't bid for an Olympic Games. They are bidding for something that will give them a reason to hurry up infrastructure and the vision for
a
city.
So that bringing forward effect that you...
Exactly. Yeah. And so, understandably, those sorts of things are going to run over budget. It becomes very difficult to measure some of the legacy prospects. I mean, I know with the, you know, the extra rail extension that was put on in Sydney, Olympic Park, that is widely used, you know, and suburbs have been built up around that post-2000. So, and how do you also measure the sense of people living in the area. And one that I think is really important. So Sochi is probably recognised as the most expensive Olympics ever. Right. That was the Winter Olympics in 2014. And I think the cost for that was about 21.9 billion US at a cost overrun of 289%. But the fact is, I remember speaking to a lot of people that lived in Sochi. They had nothing before the Games began. And I know when they were announced as an Olympic host city, we tried to ring people here on the ABC that lived in Sochi to comment on what it would mean, what they thought. And seriously, the only businesses we could find were pretty much brothels. And we didn't want to put them on air.
Fair enough too.
However, being at Sochi and watching what happened with the Games, they have now attracted any other number of major events to the area. It's been developed as a bit of a winter resort and a summer resort. The people like it because they have an economy that they didn't have before. So these are sort of big picture stuff. When you come to things like Athens in 2004, that was the first Games after 9/11. So effectively, the security budget that was then added as overlay to an Olympic budget sent the country broke.
Yeah.
So these are sort of the unforeseen circumstances. Tokyo's in the same boat with COVID. Yeah. Who would have thought?
Yeah, that one's going to blow out in all unimaginably, I would have thought. All right, let's, Leonie, we heard Tracy say there that there's been a tourism boost for Sochi overall. That's one of the things we do hear about a lot in terms of the Olympics is the tourism boost. Presumably there is a massive spike round about the time of the actual Olympics, but are there really long-term benefits to tourism from hosting an Olympic Games?
Typically, there is a spike, of course, immediately after the Games, and I think for Sydney that lasted 2-3 years, but then we have seen a return to a normal a scale or range of growth, of course, pre-COVID. So, yes, typically we do tend to see that spike, and certainly the destination promotion benefits of the Olympics, the fact that the whole world is effectively focused on your destination for those 16 days that the Olympics is hosted, you know, that is very much an intangible that is incredibly important.
But Leonie, am I right in taking it that in fact, it's not like it actually sort of creates a net, like a long-term effect that doesn't sustain over time? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Look, I think there are spikes and certainly then activity will return to normal. And I think we need to recognise in the case of Australia that we are a long, travel destination. Yeah. We're not...
Oh, sounds like
Europe. We just cross the borders, so to speak. So, you know, that is a factor for us. That yes, certainly there might be a greater intention to visit, but certainly that might only be once.
Right.
And once that goes through the system, then we return to our normal travel patterns, but over an extended period of time.
Is it more, Tracy Holmes, about sort of making a longer-term decision to get into the mega event market? I mean, you're saying that there are other games that come afterwards. Is that really the way to try and make a sustainable benefit out of hosting an Olympic Games?
No, I don't think it is for Australia because the point Leonie just made, we're so far away.
Yeah.
I think in terms of tourism, Barcelona recognised there was a difference for about 7 years, so it was more sustained, but there's a lot of people that are a lot closer. And it also comes back to other aspects feeding in, you know, Tourism Australia campaigns, international campaigns trying to drive people to the country. You can't just have an Olympic Games in isolation and hope it's going to have an impact. But one thing I'll point out in this idea of hosting mega events, I think mega events are changing. I think the International Olympic Committee has really recognised that, particularly with Tokyo and a number of other games in recent memory. And so they're looking at not so much the big bill and the extravagant infrastructure, but more what can be hosted that fits into the urban environment already, which is why we see the introduction of new sports that has so many people up in arms, like skateboarding, surfing,
breakdancing. A lot of talk about breakdancing this week.
Exactly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Exactly. But also... The Australia is going to co-host the FIFA Women's World Cup in 2023 with New Zealand, and that'll be shared around a number of cities. But for the first time ever, FIFA, an international organisation, maintaining control of the organising committee, which is something very different. Mm. Because what has happened in the past is these contracts that you sign with the IOC or FIFA basically say any cost overruns, sorry, you're up for that. We have nothing to do with that. Mm. And so as demands increase and the overruns increase, the city has to fork out more and more money. So it'll be interesting to see when FIFA takes control of the organising committee, what sort of a difference, because responsibility will be on their shoulders.
Absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned as well the co-hosting thing. It seems to me that there's been more co-hosting in recent years. David Rowe is sort of spreading the hosting burden between more than one location. Is it a trend, and is it a way of spreading the risk better?
It is a trend, and if you look at the Brisbane bid that 2032 that's coming together, it's actually presented as more of a regional, southeastern Queensland regional bid than specifically a Brisbane bid. I mean, the point, I suppose, is that mega events are getting less mega. They're shrinking to some degree. Partly that's in response to the shrinking number of bidders. I mean, that's something that...
What's driving that shrinking number of bidders, other than all these budget overruns that we've been citing with Abandon this morning?
Well, because especially kind of citizen groups are much more assertive now about what's in it for us. And so a number of bids haven't gone ahead because... people have got together in Budapest or Boston or Hamburg, and all of which had advanced Olympic bids in the making and essentially pulled out. If you take the case of Hamburg, they had a citizens' referendum there, and it lost. And I like to point out it lost by almost exactly the same percentage as the Brexit win. it seems to be somewhere between 52% and 48% seems to be the kind of the kind of focal point for such a contentious decision.
That's really interesting, Tracy. I see you nodding in agreement about that idea of sort of local civic groups becoming more vocal earlier on,
And even governments putting it to, or city structures putting it to the people, saying we'd like to do this. What do you think? And it's interesting because coming back to the Oxford report that you mentioned in the beginning, they actually said, what if every city that wanted to bid for the Olympic Games said, okay, here we go, folks, it's going to cost us $5 billion or $12 billion or whatever. Would you like that for a two-week party and perhaps some flow-on effects afterwards? Or would you like us to divide that money up equally between all of us?
You wouldn't quite be 48, 52 on that one, would you? And Tracy, look, the cynics might suggest that historically the IOC hasn't been a model of transparency and best practice. Is the actual process of bidding for an Olympic Games better than it used to be, and does the IOC require more in terms of this sort of legacy-led planning these days?
Look, I think it's true they haven't been, but point to one that is best practice and, full transparency, et cetera, et cetera. What's happened, as David mentioned, less cities started bidding for the Games sort of through the 2000s, and so the IOC was made to take a good hard look at how this whole system was going to work. And Brisbane is one of these that has come into the new system where they enter into a series of dialogues with interested cities. And so that's a bit different, and I think it actually takes some of the transparency away. So it is a little bit less transparent, which is a bit of a concern. So it's interesting how these things kind of evolve and how they roll about. But as David said, there's so much more engagement now with the people and population and other civic groups that keep the pressure on. And most definitely, the IOC is aware of that. Hmm. And they are aware of having to address these issues, these groups, etc. Right up to the point that even in the last week or so, they've recognised they're going to bring in a human rights unit and look very carefully at human rights. There's a human rights clause now inserted into every host city contract, right, which is a new thing. And they're under a lot of pressure because the next Winter Olympics in 2022 are in Beijing. And there's all sorts of pressure taking place, as you can understand.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We're talking about whether or not cities should be putting their hand up to host an Olympic Games in light of the 2032 Olympics feasibility study from Brisbane. And we're joined by Tracy Holmes, host of the ABC podcast The Ticket, Associate Professor Leonie Loxton Binney from Griffith University's Business School, and David Rowe, Emeritus Professor of Cultural Research at Western Sydney University. Leonie, can I ask you for your thoughts on the IOC bid process and your response to Tracy's thoughts about how that's changed and improved, but also maybe not quite as transparent?
So certainly, I think picking up on Tracy's point that the IOC have recognised that potentially the cost of bidding and hosting the Games has become unsustainable. So they are moving to this model of what they're calling the new norm, which is essentially giving host cities a greater level of freedom and flexibility in terms of how the Olympics is effectively delivered, in view of making the Olympics more sustainable, more beneficial for the host community, and also more affordable. So in terms of that, we're seeing a move, I think, more to temporary venues instead of building those, you know, huge stadiums, which in some cases, as we've already talked about, are not always effectively used after the Games. And as Tracy was just mentioning, this ongoing dialogue with host cities and host destinations. The other big, I think, point of difference potentially with the SEQ bid and 2032 is that the IOC have already committed an amount of funds to support the bid, and I think it's effectively $1.8 billion. And off the back of that, the feasibility study and the value proposition assessment is suggesting that the actual organising costs of the Games can be neutral to the Queensland taxpayer. Whether that actually occurs or not, we will need to wait and see.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. David Rowe, is the Olympics in any way different because it is sort of the biggest? Does that give it particular challenges and make it harder to run? Or are the issues that we're discussing things that really apply to any large event, even, say, the Commonwealth Games or, you know, the World Cup that Tracy mentioned?
Well, the Olympics is one of the biggest. I mean, there are, I guess, arguments about whether the FIFA World Cup is bigger. I think it is a bigger event. I mean, this whole question of the giganticism of the Olympics has been a real question. And because it's the Olympics come to town, and because it's such a long lead-in, it's obviously a very significant. It's very disruptive, and the legacy is not always positive, as we've said.
But I suppose what I'm wondering, though, is there a meaningful difference, say, between, like, would any of our panellists say, if you had a choice between hosting the Olympics or a World Cup, is there one which is just likely to be better in terms of the host city's overall outcome?
Well, the Olympics is, it has a kind of historical weight to it that others, other events don't have. And I would also want to mention the Paralympics too, something which, you know, Sydney, yes, 2000 really gave a kick along to. And so if you think of the Olympics and the Paralympics together as a package, I mean, that's, obviously very significant. It's as for all kinds of other events, as you say, there might be smaller, more compact, fewer events. I mean, just having a single sport event is much easier to run than something like the Olympics and the Paralympics with, so many, in many cases, arcane types of sport involved. So, I mean, if I was a manager of such things, or event manager, I would go for a single sport like the FIFA World Cup, okay, rather than something as complex as Philippines.
Well, let's not just make you manager, Tracy Holmes. Let's appoint you mayor for life of a city with your fingers with access to the infrastructure budget. What sort of mega event would you choose to host, and why?
Look, I can't choose between the Olympics. Having covered 12 of them, I've covered every single Youth Olympic Games, yep, which is held every 2 years since 2010, and I've covered a number of FIFA World Cups as well. And they're both extremely dynamic in different ways. And there's lots of things you can't measure. It's impossible to measure, you know, the health benefit. And you hope that by hosting something and inspiring a city or a state or a nation, that you get the population to be more active and more involved. But again, it doesn't happen by itself. There's always an immediate spike afterwards of kids enrolling in different sports that they've seen. But that needs to be sustained by ongoing education or PR programs or whatever. It's not going to just stay there. But for every dollar spent in sport, there's supposed to be a $7 saving in the health budget. So these things can be worthwhile. They can be beneficial, but you just can't let them run out of control.
Yeah, and Leonie Loxton Binney, in the end, is it sort of foolishness and ego that makes us go into these things, or is it the fact that, as Tracy says, there just are these intangible benefits that, even though they're harder to measure, they are ultimately real, and they make cities everywhere feel like it was a worthwhile process? Do you think that's the real reason behind cities like Brisbane bidding and everyone taking on these financial risks?
Look, I think there is certainly ego, and politicians do love these mega events. In saying that, there are all of these feel-good factors that, you know, certainly when a city is hosting the Olympics or the World Cup, they are big, big spectacles. They focus attention on those host cities. They give a sense of pride to the community, and all of these things, as you've just suggested, are very much very difficult to measure as opposed to the more economic side of things. But it's this question of, until we really do a cost-benefit analysis and everything's laid out on the table, it's one where we all have an opinion, and our opinion might vary.
Well, I was certainly a cynic before the Sydney 2000 Games, and I was very pro at the end of it, I'll say. So the vibe picked up for me. So maybe that'll be the same for Brisbane in 2032. Thanks very much to all our guests on the roundtable today. Thanks very much, Tracy Holmes from the Ticket Podcast.
Thanks, Julian.
Great to see you as always. Thanks to Associate Professor Leonie Loxton Binney from Griffith University. Thanks very much, Leonie.
Thank you, Julian.
And thanks also to David Rowe, Emeritus Professor of Cultural Research at the Western Sydney University.
Thank you, Julian, and fellow panellists.